A little more than half an hour for questions, so it's plenty of time. I wanted to start off the discussion with a question of my own. First of all, thank you. All three of you brought up really great ideas and a lot of questions. I think everyone touched on this issue of the fact that we can't think of ourselves as architects designing a building that will solve this problem, that we have to think much more expansively and collaboratively about what we're doing. Obviously, there's no point in designing a building that has a badger-friendly facade when next to it is a highway where the badgers don't survive. So thinking about, you know, architecture and urban planning and traffic management, all those issues. But my question is, I guess, that some of those issues are more resistant than others, right? Some, let's say a community garden might kind of think of a space that's available and a space that's available in the city as something they can use, and the city might be willing to give that. But a highway is not something that we can easily kind of overcome. And I think traffic in the city is something that isn't likely to go away. So I guess that's my question, the issue of traffic planning, and do we need to rethink cities in general with a completely new way of thinking about mobility? Or how do we integrate these issues in a city like New York where, you know, 50% of the land is about the road?
I think that part of the problem starts with trying to think of a solution that operates on a singular ground plane. But I think there might be special solutions to some of these problems. So in terms of practicalities, I hope that later on Jeff and I will be able to refer to some projects that are, of course, not ours, but projects done by others that begin to suggest very practical solutions to or inroads to some of these issues. But there's also another question involved that I only remembered when preparing my luggage for the symposium. All of a sudden I remembered Little Green Book. This doesn't come out of Libya, it comes out of Germany. That was sitting in my bookshelf for a while, and it came out 2008, published in German language. The author is a zoologist, his name is Reichholf, and I guess translated into English, the title is Stable Disequilibria, the Ecology of the Future. And the reason why I remembered that is, in principle, beside the practicalities and solving some of the issues to do with the kind of the themes that we're dealing with today, I think one of the overarching questions is, what are we actually really doing? And this book by Reichholf is a particular kind of critique of a type of nature conservation that is basically there to maintain a certain status quo, i.e. there were so and so many elephants in this region, so there will be fluctuations to that, but we have to maintain this. And he refers to this model as a dynamic equilibria approach. Basically, you have a snapshot of a condition, you try and maintain that. And he sets against that a different approach. It says, okay, you know, ecosystems and species evolve over time. So maybe rather than maintaining a condition, we need to maintain a process that he calls stable disequilibria. In other words, we have to allow things to evolve. And that's the process we have to maintain. The question is, when you bring this to an urban context, perhaps there isn't something to start with. What do you do? Do you take the inroad of the Norwegian government that basically says we are going to reconstruct the state of 1890? If you're lucky enough, it was documented or not. Or what is it really that you put there into place? And then how do you maintain the things that are put into place? So it's also about maintenance. It's also about facilitation. But in this case, it's not about the practicalities of how do you make sure the badgers have ways of moving around without being run over by the car. It's a question, why do you have badgers to start with? And if you do introduce them, will you allow them to disappear due to processes that are taking place that are maybe other than being run over by a car? So I think the issue of practicality and the issue of conceptual take, they are in some way very intensely interrelated, and they deserve thinking also from the side of designers on all of these levels.
So it's a question of maybe thinking about the city as evolving or having the possibility to evolve as well, not just nature, but the city, the way that we think about what are the givens and what is the way that we travel, for example, at the minute, and how can we rethink that so that that evolves at the same time?
Well, I would also argue that you think of Manhattan as a traffic-centric city, but you know there are many examples of cities that have managed to kind of de-traffic themselves to a large degree, and it is an interesting spatial design problem, which is to say, you know, if you thought about it almost abstractly, right, and said, okay, like here's the Manhattan grid, I know how people travel. It was an interesting proposition. What would you actually have to do to be able to create a sort of interconnected network of greenway through Manhattan that would support certain kinds of things? And my suspicion is, I was just thinking about it, I actually don't think it's that hard to do. Like, the idea that you couldn't drive up to the front of your house in a car is maybe, that's a behavioral condition that's unthinkable. But I think from a spatial and transit point of view, my suspicion is that, especially because you could start on a small scale and see if it worked, which would be the right way to do it, my suspicion is it's not that hard to solve it that way. So in a way, it's also a sense of how we construct the expectation of the city. I mean, to me, that was always the real insight from Delirious New York, was that we construct the city of, we live in the city of our own expectations, or is what we construct. So how do we construct the expectation of the city where you can't drive to your front door, but you have to walk half a block in Manhattan? How far is that? 400 feet, not that bad.
Well, the interesting thing about Delirious New York and some of the utopian projections for New York is that circulation was never meant to be a single plain circulation. It was a spatial kind of solution. And I think within these kinds of spatial solutions, we will also find enough opportunity to organize provisions
for the first piece of that, right?
Yeah.
Do we have questions from the floor? I think we have a few microphones.
Not so much a question, but a follow-up to Caroline's question. If we're looking for these kinds of opportunities in the city, it seems like we might actually look at the form of the city as a sort of fundamental opportunity, because every city is different, and every city has a different configuration of open spaces and spaces that are opening because of their political and economic evolution. And so that the dynamism that we're looking for in terms of creating these new ecologies is sort of, in a way, built into the city's own interaction with its ground. And it just seems like we've been talking about buildings and been talking about the region, but we haven't been talking about the actual configuration of the city.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, the other part of that is that it's one of those, to me, I think that it's this sort of funny contradiction that we feel the need to act on a scale in which we have to act at a systemic level, and yet inevitably we need enough specificity that can interact with, like, the sort of, as I think Michael's comment about, all the stuff that can go on in 5 meters of ground in a city, which could be so different from New York to Toronto to Paris. And I suspect that maybe thinking of the city again as a kind of series of niches and habitats, and not drawing such strong distinctions between the conceptual distinctions between the pieces, might be a way to think of that. I mean, even from the lecture last night, right? That, you know, we tend to take for granted that the building always has to be a building, and the park always has to be a park, and the street always has to be a street. And maybe that's the beginnings of a way to think about that, you know, because that's what you're pointing out, is that that is always a temporary condition, right?
Maybe I can add a small comment to that. I guess the theme of the symposium is indicative that we're looking for ways in which architecture can support and underpin urban ecology efforts. And if urban ecology operates on a series of particular scales, then maybe the aggregation or accumulation of built form into a kind of urban morphology is definitely part of it, and it's somewhere the meeting ground, I would say. The point is not that we disregard it, the point is just to see on a much smaller scale what it can we actually do to underpin these processes and efforts. So yes, urban form by all means, and morphology, the kind of resulting conditions of accumulative building efforts and so on, what is coming out of that? Of course, this is very significant.
Well, Philip Beasley, I'm absolutely tantalized by the set of models that all four of you have offered today, and I want to ask a question about quantification, perhaps as a way of working with what you said you have presented in a practical way. In terms of the systems that you've offered us, I mean, Caroline, your diagram of the Ingalls kind of new model of an involved human body, Michael, the kind of argument for increments of buildings feeding into larger atmospheric systems and the kind of language that you were offering of interconnectedness, and Kevin, the argument for wedges contributing in absolutely specific, you know, explicit ways in order to work with a formidably large, almost a horrifically large challenge. And Marianne, your argument for social actions, perhaps tiny tribal tribal organizations making for a tangible resilience. Each one of these seems to be tremendously valuable set of models of interconnectedness, which might give us a language. But perhaps the elephant in the room is a question of effectiveness. Because implicit in all of these discussions is an attack on top-down systems, and yet with top-down systems, like that balloon spewing out artificial clouds, we have the possibility of very quick transformation at the scale which some of us might argue is absolutely essential. We heard kind of a lurking sense of how it might just be kind of self-aggrandizing to wear a little badge and be happy with our tribal action, after all, a kind of greenwashing. So I want to ask about quantification. Can you please speculate on what kinds of measures might be enabling for designers of architecture today? There's a risk where, you know, working with generating the systems themselves, the kind of language that you're offering, is an early practice which can't afford to have its bluff called. You know, I mean, we could say that it's wrong, destructive, to call the question of capitalizing such a practice and seeing how much it will actually contribute, because the task might be to get it going, to be able to visualize the possibility of something, and the fiction might be a very welcome state. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the elephant in the room is one of what kind of impact can we actually have? And when we think of Buckminster Fuller saying 60 years ago, "Madam, how much does your building weigh?" Or organizations today like Zero Footprint who give tangible access to carbon counting, or perhaps the emerging practice of stoichiometry, that is of chemical quotient counting, mm-hmm. in terms of understanding our impacts. It's very tempting to say that it's urgent to quantify. Could you speculate about how designers might start to count within the systems that you've offered? What kind of measures would be positive?
Well, I can start and try not to answer a different question, but I will start with answering a slightly different question, and that is, I think you're raising the larger issue of, do these practices matter? Like the ones I'm looking at, community gardens or community forestry or oyster restoration, these very small scale efforts. And that's a question I ask myself all the time, because I agree with you that, you know, this is not gonna solve carbon consumption in China, for example, and there, top-down approach might have some amazing impacts in a very short time. On the other hand, as a scholar, this is what I like to study, and so I have to sort of justify my existence, and I'm not gonna change at this point in my career, most likely. And so, sort of in the larger sense, the way I think about this is that these are, as I said, they're sort of local stewardship adaptations. They're showing how people can adapt, right? So people are adapting, let's say in Detroit now, that's a huge example, people are adapting to this sort of massive destruction of buildings. I mean, I've seen it happen, you know, in 2 weeks. The interesting thing is I live in Fall Creek, the neighborhoods where it's happening looks like my neighborhood. They'll just be places, I look at it as all different stages of succession where there'll be houses that are nicely painted and right next door to one that's, you know, says for sale. And a few blocks down is one that's been burned out because as soon as they're vacated, somebody inhabits them, and it's usually drug gangs, and then they burn each other out, essentially. And then a few blocks down, there'll be one that's being scraped up, and you know, the whole site is now vacant. So I forget where I go. So anyways, so what they're doing in Detroit now is you see all this sort of civic renewal around greening, right? It's sort of an adaptive response to a disturbance. So if we think of these as sort of DIY sort of adaptive responses, then the potential exists that as we have greater disturbance, which we will, as we've seen with Sandy, and we're actually doing a little bit of research on how people are responding to Sandy, who are doing community gardening or other activities in the city. Is there value in sort of studying these adaptive responses and knowing how people then maybe will respond to larger sort of disturbances? In terms of, there's a couple other things, and one is that research has shown, and Janice Dickinson in my department's done a really nice review synthesis paper on this, that negative messaging doesn't necessarily spur people to do the right action, right? So if I tell you that, you know, the world's coming to an end because of the way we're consuming carbon, a likely reaction is that you're gonna go out and buy a bigger car because that's gonna make you feel less vulnerable to this world coming to the end scenario. The terror management theory that she's written about. So, you know, these are kind of maybe positive, in a sense, Pollyannish messages that I'm giving, but there's probably a role for those too, because they kind of can keep people sort of engaged and maybe working towards solutions. And then the final thing about quantification in here, you know, there's sort of the very small level, right? So one of the things, basically what I laid is out is a framework, and then I have individual students who are working on individual projects. Like I have a student who looked at sense of place. He did a quantitative study on sense of place. There's sort of, this is a construct that's been quantified. You can do it with surveys. Outcomes of engagement in these practices amongst youth. Or Phil Silva, as I've mentioned several times, is doing some exploration of what kind of monitoring are people doing, and can we see what's feasible for them. So they're like monitoring innovations, essentially, that these the ones that are a little higher capacity, community gardens or oyster or whatever, what are they coming up with that then we might help spread to the others so that they can build their capacity to actually measure it. And then I think the last part is just we really have to think about networking, and I showed that slide as this sort of networking around a resource, so it's Sustainable South Bronx. So it's easy for all those organizations to work together because they're in the Bronx River watershed and they really identify with that. But if you have community gardens there, a patch here, a patch here, a patch here, right? There's no physical connectivity. So I think they're connected around some ideology, and there is a American Community Gardening Association, and there's several. What, you know, the older, there's been lots of, you know, there's Victory Gardens, and there's the community gardens of the 70s, which is what we still see in New York City a lot, but they're sort of more social, natural places. They weren't really growing food. But now we have the more recent movement in Detroit, and we'll see a lot of sort of younger people moving back into cities who are doing this as more of a food. So, but there's some kind of ideology that connects people. So if we can create be the broker, then we can help them maybe increase their capacity and help them actually to measure that. So I don't know if that's helpful. I'll stop there. But it's definitely really sort of the heart of the question for somebody who's working at these very community-based, you know, small-scale efforts.
So I'd answer that by saying that measurement is critical, because when I was saying that we need this sort of Cambrian explosion of design, we also need a kill function to weed out things that don't work very well. And so when we think of explicit metrics, the difficulty we have is measuring this sort of emergent condition the conditions that we're looking for. So I think one of the things we can actually look to is these techniques of measurement that come out of ecology and urban ecology, I think can actually really help us as architects, right? Like this idea, I love that story that Michael tells, like, how the hell do I know if this is an invasive species, if this is good or bad? Count whether or not the insects are there, find a way of measuring whether it's integrated into the ecosystem. So I think the metric is really important, because at some point we have to make decisions that things, I think we have to try a lot, but we may find a lot of stuff doesn't work. And so then we have to get rid of it, and we have to do it very quickly. I myself, in a lot of my other work with building simulation, I also think that, you know, I tend to think, and I talk about it, that we can use various kinds of simulation and analogous, both physical simulation and physical computing and regular old virtual computing, as you might say, to try and simulate things, to give people tools to attempt to sort of think through or work through particular strategies without having to go to the full commitment for them, to have a better sense that they might be effective. But I think the development of some metrics is inevitably and critical, because otherwise the problem is then the discussion about the effectiveness of things becomes highly political, and once it becomes highly political without any kind of measurement behind it, it's fairly easy to then subvert and move towards an outcome that is, let's say, beneficial to the groups of people for whom things tend to be beneficial, if you know what I mean. So I have a lot of hope in some of these metrics. I mean, as another example, I was looking with a thesis student. We were looking at, she's interested in studying how can you sort of increase bird populations in certain places in New York City. And, you know, as a proposition, it's hard for her to develop a metric, but she can certainly develop a metric that measures correlation between what she sees as architectural or social, architectural or spatial conditions in the city and measured populations of birds, right? And one of the things that's interesting, where I think as architects we would do well to sort of adapt some more rigorous mathematical methods, is that, you know, she sort of says, well, these things sort of seem to be near each other. And I suggested to her that, in fact, using the GIS software, you can actually measure whether or not there really are near each other or not. And you can have a real mathematical correlation there. You run a spatial correlation on ArcGIS, right? And as architects, we don't really do that very often, but I think it would help us a lot to learn from the natural sciences of how they deal with measuring. I mean, ecology has many methods for measuring complex systems that I think could be really useful, especially if we have lots of data gathering to sift through.
Maybe just a small comment. I think Mike Wells presented a very succinct argument yesterday about economy as measurement, and that also applies to the way in which we operate. For instance, Norway has very significant local climate differences. And what we're trying to do now is figure out just how significant are those. So we're trying to utilize some of the technologies that Kevin was talking about early on to build very cheap weather stations, of which we could have many over an area of 1 square kilometer. Maybe choose an area where we have significant variation up to 10 degrees centigrade over a given season. And the point is to challenge if it turns out to be a significant difference, the kind of uniform standard building regulations which are applied all over Norway in terms of climate envelope, for instance. So the point is first to see how significant are the local climate differences. If we put a safety factor into it to account for fluctuation, is there still a significant difference? And then we would follow up with some conceptual and some design work to think, how could architecture respond to variation of that kind of sort? How would standards need to be rethought along these kinds of lines and so on? So practically the validity of the hypothesis is underpinned by, in the first instance, very particular measurements.
Yeah, I would add a comment to that on a project that I'm working on right now with the Industrial Labor Relations School, ILR school here, where the metric we're looking at, you know, New York State subsidizes all kinds of like green renovations and green things to do, not for buildings, partially. And one of the things, it's akin to what Michael mentioned, which is that we think that it would make a lot of sense policy-wise to use a metric that one has to do with economic development, meaning job creation, and the other one having to do with CO2 footprint, and using simulation to test out how the specificity of local climates and local economies may enable us to develop, say, like a regulatory mechanism that will allow a very targeted subsidy as opposed to a generic subsidy, right? And so that's a that's kind of a tech, that's a technology that depends on simulation that encourages or doesn't encourage certain kinds of architectural, real architectural activity, right? That's another example where you can imagine that you underpin a policy with some sort of hybrid metric that somehow, I mean, it's only really two things, but it's interesting to try and think of how you strike that balance, because that's, again, another issue. Is like the single metric is a difficult thing in the ecosystem model.
Philip, I want to say I take my job of moderator very seriously, and I'm really supposed to ask questions and not answer them. But I will say something in response to your question. I've watched the sustainability movement, in the worst case scenario, become a marketing ploy. So, for example, the glass tower should not be a sustainable building model, but we architects and the world have an idea that we want a glass tower for whatever reason, that we were told in the past that transparency is good or whatever reason. And so, you know, there are examples of sustainable architecture that are glass towers when really we should be questioning what is the motivation for that form or materiality in the first place. And I think that's why I ask the question, and also goes to Jeremy's question about what, you know, not making the same mistake at the urban scale. What is it that we want? And maybe we should think about those things in first principles. So looking at what are the weather systems that we're dealing with initially. So going back to the question of metrics, in the architectural case, those issues are maybe very simple. So there's a question of orientation and a question of materiality or opacity related to that on the scale of the tower. And maybe at the urban scale, it doesn't have to be that complex if you think about it at first principles. And I think this is going back to what Michael said about thinking about space first and then thinking about technology. So maybe something as simple as the orientation of a grid in the city can change everything about the way that city responds to its environment.
Hi. My question relates actually pretty closely to some of the responses you just gave. But I'm interested in the idea of currency and value. And every time I hear somebody up front say, is there a value in it, I hear return on investment. And so when I hear, you know, the idea of social capital or metrics or trying to frame some of these questions in different ways, particularly when I hear something about a flower that we judge its value based on how many insects are interested in it, what I wonder is, do we really have any room for metrics besides currency? Or really are we just iterating our metrics until we get to a return on investment? I'm wondering if there's space in your minds in the realm of design to not be trying to figure out how to market this, and whether or not the green movement, which is supposedly good for everyone, can be anything other in the end than a green brand, which is really good for just a few people.
Well, all right, I'll try and answer that, which is, I actually think it's quite easy to have systems or metrics of value that are not ultimately tied to currency. Like, we have lots of them socially, right? I think the question is, can we get structures that are designed to respond to those metrics, to respond to other kinds of metrics? And the way that we traditionally have done that is through political processes. Right here in the United States. So it's like, you know, I mean, in the most extreme example, you could argue that people responded to potentially situations, say the response of a civil rights movement that doesn't make economic sense, right? But I don't think for certain people it did, but the argument was made not on an economic grounds that it was wrong, but on other grounds. So I think that there are lots of metrics other than currency. The question is, can we get the powers that be to accept them is really what your question is, because I don't think we have any trouble thinking them up. And I suppose in my mind, it's always going to be a political process, and I would like to think that having some science and having some real, not facts and numbers behind the other metrics that you propose ends up being critical to winning that argument. But I also agree with you that the question of whether sustainability can be anything other than a brand, will evolve beyond anything other than a branding exercise, or I don't think it started that way. I think it's actually evolved into a branding exercise because it scares people, a lot of people. That's an open question, right? We don't know the answer to that question, and we probably, I don't think, won't know for quite some time, to be honest with you.
I think we have time for one more.
Okay, thank you. This is a very enjoyable sort of opportunity to think about the role of the architect moving forward with ecological applications and how to situate the architect within the context of this broader movement towards urban sustainability and urban ecology. I'm curious, I want to try to dig in a little bit deeper. We're in a situation now where ecologists are shifting to study and understand urban systems, but have essentially avoided urban habitats for a century. And so it's a fairly new field that's developing, and not a lot of data really on ecosystem processes in urban areas, not to mention a very well-formulated understanding of how we define these human ecosystems in terms of SES perspectives, as well as what we're understanding as viable biological communities within an urban context. So the ecologists are evolving their understanding and definitions of urban ecosystems. And now the architect designer is getting very interested in trying to adapt or integrate that either information or methods of research into their process of design. So these are all moving parts, none of which have been established yet. So we don't really have the data to make choices and decisions about how to design architecture today that's going to promote ecosystem function, other than I think the energy fields and the idea of reduction of energy impacts. But and there's the social side, I think, is starting to evolve a bit. I'm wondering what are this early stage now, let's say in the next decade, how can the architectural profession, what are the key factors or what are the big issues that the architectural profession needs to maybe think through or rejigger in order to adaptively create better relationships with scientists and with communities and with the changing world to play a bigger role?
Well, I'll try that one again. I think just one point, which is, as architects have to decide that become conversant and accepting of failure in all its forms. No architect, as you guys all know, no architect has ever failed in his own project, although many other of his colleagues have failed miserably, right? I think that we actually need to actually acknowledge that we don't always do things correctly, and the only way, the problem with architecture that I see from an experimentalist point of view is it's a really costly experiment, right, to build the houses, which is why I get interested in simulation. But I think we have to make these experiments and honestly evaluate them, because our choices are to continue with business as usual. So I would say propose experiments. It's not like we don't know anything. So a good, well-informed guess based on what you know, I think, is better than the status quo. And then be perfect. Try things, in my mind, try things that are that can be evaluated in fairly short term, right? And then if you got it wrong, admit it. You know, I worked for a firm, which I won't name, who got a bunch of stuff wrong, and like, you know, they would never admit it. That a building that you thought was going to perform a certain way, you made your best effort to make it perform that way, and you were wrong, and it didn't perform that way. We can't, for various reasons, we never.
Very much. There's been many academic works written about what was not achieved by those projects I showed. And of course, what I was trying to show is what actually happens in real projects that I was dealing with. And all the good things were emphasized, of course, because we're wonderful and great and brilliant and we want more work. But actually, there was a hell of a lot that we didn't do. And why didn't we do it? What just an aside, I chaired EcoBuild Nail School with 3,000 delegates not about four years ago. And the thing that really hit me was the techno solutions and the social constructs and all this. We are so clever. We have a lot of this stuff worked out, but it's not being implemented in most schemes. You do major master planning or regeneration master planning. And for some reason in the West, and I think Kevin hit the nail on the head several times in what he said about the systems that are railed against this working, is that it doesn't get rolled out on major projects because there are so many systems in place politically and economically to keep things going along in the same old way they've done for ages. One of those is the fact that they don't incentivize in government for sustainable, flexible design. Hardly at all. They do a bit in Germany, but in the UK, virtually not at all. So the incentives are poor. The inertia is huge because of the indemnity system. So you're going to deliver a landscape or a building, and if you don't deliver it according to a brief, you're going to get sued if it doesn't perform. So we've got that whole system of indemnity and finance backed up by the political system behind that. So, for example, the athletes village I talked about yesterday, thousands of tricks missed in terms of things like sustainable food production, the flexible sort of wonderful ecosystems you just described in the Bronx and whatever, which is what I would have liked to see. You can't deliver that in a major master plan in the West because there's no mechanism that permits you to deliver flexibility. You know, you have to deliver some wonderful construct that you, for a population, incidentally, that doesn't even exist yet because they haven't moved in yet. So what architects should do to answer that gentleman's rather apocalyptic question about architecture is get political, because actually the biggest problem is getting people to permit and facilitate all the good stuff we already know how to do and actually make it feasible to integrate and lock in these systems, build in flexibility, incentivize social flexibility and that little bit of anarchy that creates the resilience that you've been describing so eloquently, and not cut out the expert, bonfire of the experts, but make experts do what they do best, which is occasionally give the ship a bit of a steer. If we're, say, for example, promoting an invasive alien species because we think, well, it's got a right to be here, just like anything else, because without realizing that it's killing everything else off because we didn't do the science. So scientists and experts and architects have a serious role to play as experts, but it needs to be in a certain focused way. But I think our biggest problem is a political one. It's a political one in terms of delivery, and I think, cynically, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of big powers at work keeping it that way.
May I add a small comment? I personally think that architecture is gradually gearing up towards this task through a different inroad, and that inroad is embracing more and more proper research undertakings, which help a lot to first of all, inform the proposals in a much more significant and robust way, but also to inform maybe a greater public about the significance of these undertakings. And by virtue of doing that, I think in some sort of grassroots fashion, this creates also a certain political demand. So I think that there are certain ways in which architects and architecture as a discipline is gearing up today that could become quite significant, hopefully. I like to be optimistic because otherwise I have to cease being an architect.
I think we have to wrap up for the break, but hopefully we have two more opportunities for this kind of discussion and then the